Welcome to the Good, the Bad and the Ugly podcast with me, Tony Morell. And this week's special guest is ex-boxing promoter, manager, trainer, and TV personality, Kelly Maloney.
I don't know about the TV personality, but thanks for inviting me on.
Well, listen, we're really looking forward to you sharing the Good, the Bad and the Ugly with us, Kelly. How are we?
I'm good, thanks. And I'm glad. Thanks for coming out to Portugal, because not many want to come out and see how I've changed my life. And I live very peaceful here in the Algarve. And I'd still go back to England, because my heart is always will be in England, and I'm English, but I have an Irish passport. Don't tell anyone.
No, just listen. We've spoken, you know, for a couple of months now and stuff, and we're just absolutely buzzing that, you know, agreed to, you know, for you to share your story and, you know, a life which is, you know, which we're going to get into, and I think it's, you know, raising awareness and, you know, sporting background, with especially within the boxing and stuff. And you know, you were a promoter and a manager and a trainer and stuff in the boxing world, and the likes of Lennox Lewis, who, you know, went on to become heavyweight world champion of the world. And there's many stories that we're going to get into, and also stuff that, you know, your personal life as well. And so I just want to say thank you for inviting us, myself, my wife and Chris, to this lovely place in Portugal. So I just want to get into it, where you grew up, where you're from, and what family life was like.
Yeah, well, I was born to, I'm sure everyone's heard so much of my story, they'll all be fed up of it, but we'll go over it again. I was born to, obviously, a working-class Irish family. My father was a builder, a real character, was a Millwall supporter, and that's why I've always supported him. Dad, I never forgive you for taking me to Millwall.
My daughter's the same about Everton, like,
you know, but I've been going there since I was 3 years old, and I still never miss a game. I can watch every game here in Portugal on the TV, I'm lucky, glad to say.
So you're a diehard Millwall fan?
Yeah, and when I'm home, I try and get to a few games, but I haven't been sort of to a live game for a while. Quite a few of my friends, you know, I'm getting old now, quite a few of my friends have passed away or they're not able to go, so I haven't really hooked up with anyone. But I stay in touch with a number of Millwall players. I still speak to the ex-Liverpool goalkeeper that came to us, Tony Warner. Tony Warner, really nice guy, because he used to come down to our boxing gym. I stay in touch with Brian King, who was also really one of our good goalkeepers. And we have a goalkeeper that lives out here, Brian Horn. So I see him every so often floating around the place. So, yeah, and I always speak to Dave Burns and Terry Urlock. So I've still got
a lot of legends there, like, yeah, as well, isn't there? Yeah.
And obviously, Razor Ruddock, another one from up on the wrong side of the Mersey side.
Yeah, because
but we had that great player that left us and went to you.
Tim Cahill, yeah.
Cahill, fantastic player.
And he was unbelievable for us as well.
So, you know, yeah, I remember Bill Shankly saying football is not a sport, it's a religion and a way of life. And, you know, and I met your great manager. We played you in the cup at Millwall. You came down, you beat us.
Howard Kendall.
Yes, Howard Kendall. Yeah, he was in the director's box, and, you know, we...
what a character he was.
He was a character.
I've had him on a few events and stuff, but before he sadly...
Yeah, he passed. Made a point of coming and saying hello to me, because obviously he recognised me from the boxing world, yeah.
He loved a good drink, and that he did, certainly.
Well, yeah, I don't... but we chatted. I was very happy that night, because you beat us, actually.
Well, yeah, so from family life and stuff, so your dad, you know, brought you up as a Millwall fan and stuff. Did you have any siblings, brothers, sisters?
I've got two brothers. Obviously, I was brought up in the Catholic faith because my mother, very devoted Catholic. So was my father, even though he got to certain mischief. You know, we went to Catholic school. I was an altar boy. Being the oldest of in an Irish family, they wanted me to become a priest. And I actually went away to be a priest. I went up to up your way, Southport.
Yeah, just
there's
just
a Mill Hill Missionary Seminary there. And I don't know why we had them in our school talking. And it sort of caught me. And I thought, well, if I have to be a priest, why don't I go to Africa and help teach and spread the word of the gospel? And so I went there. And at that time, everything was still in Latin. And I'm very dyslexic. So I had a lot of trouble with English. And I couldn't really get my head around the Latin.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I got there was a retreat going on where you wasn't supposed to speak to no one. He wasn't supposed to have any sweets or anything like that. And I found out where the tuck shop was, and I found a way into it, and I took the sweets out, and I was going around giving them to all the boys, and I got caught after about 4 weeks, and they phoned my parents and said, "We obviously don't think young Francis is cut out for this life, and so we're sending him back home."
Also
because I couldn't talk Latin, you know, so. So that cut that one short, I went through school. I left school without any qualifications, and I started work. I didn't go. I lived on my wits because I lived in Peckham, and we all sort of trading at weekends out of suitcases outside stations.
You're doing what you've got to do, isn't it?
Yeah, we done a little bit of burglary here and there. Thank heavens, I never got caught. I was the smallest one, so I got pushed through the windows to open the locks, and then that's all I had to do, and then I was paid for it, and then I'd just disappear. And my dad, one day, came down, and he was like, he always had great principles, my dad, and he always worked. No matter how much he drank, he never missed a day's work through sickness.
Yeah, his good values, yeah, good mods, names and stuff.
And he tried to install that in us, and he came down one day, and I was hanging at the bottom of Rye Lane, and he just grabbed me by my ear, and he went, "Let me tell you something. My son, you've got a choice. You're either going to get a job, or I'm going to put you in the army, or you can move out and hang about with all these layabouts or scallywags, as you would call them. And I went, "Okay, I'll get a job." Because I had an uncle that was a great friend of my father's who was a director in catering. So I became a trainee chef. I hated it.
It's hard calling that chef.
I totally hated it. I stuck it for about 2 years, but I had a manager that liked me, and he saw that I had a good way with people. And he said, "You're better off coming onto the management side than staying in the kitchen." So I moved onto the management side, and I worked that. And then I got a break when General Amin decided he wanted to throw all the Asians out of Uganda. They all obviously came to the UK. And there was a junior management position going in camp, a resettlement camp in Honans in Devon. So I applied for it and I got it. And I done very well there. I caused a riot, though, because I didn't realise all the Indians had all these different sort of religious and different sects at the time. So I introduced, I can't remember which group it was, let's say the Hindus, to come and work in the kitchen. I thought that's better than me doing it. And, you know, that's what managers do, because we were said to get them into society.
Trying to, like, teach them skills and stuff.
So
like that.
I'm sitting in the office, and all of a sudden I could hear plates flying everywhere, screaming going on. So the senior manager came in, "What's going on? What's going on, Maloney?" I went, "I don't know." I went out, and they were fighting because the Muslims wouldn't, and all the other
different religions,
wouldn't eat what the Hindus were cooking. Like, and then I realised, you can't have this, you know. So
all the different religions wouldn't abide to whatever they wanted them to abide to.
Yeah. So I stayed for another 3 or 4 weeks, and then I put in for, and I went back to London, and I became catering manager at Somerset House. And I really enjoyed that. And we had a function there, and Princess Margaret came. And I met her, and when she came, we were chatting, and she went, "Do me a favor," she said. "When you see my glass is empty," she said, "just top it up with gin and tonic, but don't let anyone see." You know, so I went, "Of course, like, you had to be polite. I can't remember, Your Majesty." I went, she said, "I am not the Queen, by the way."
just top a glass with gin and tonic, yeah.
Tonic, yeah. So, you know, I met quite a few, and then I eventually decided I wanted to. I was boxing as an amateur myself.
Yeah, that's what I was going to give you.
And I was quite small. I had about 69 fights, and won half and lost half. But I loved it because it was a sport where it's just one-on-one.
Yeah.
It was just you. But again, the trainer noticed that I was very good with people and asked me, "Why don't you come and join us on the training side?" Oh, no, well, what happened? I wanted to go pro because I loved the pro. I loved boxing. I just loved it.
Who can you remember from your days?
Who
did you look up to?
Well, I really got in love with it when I went and saw the management side of it, when I went and saw the first Cassius Clay, Joe Frazier fight.
Yeah.
But I love Roberto Duran. He's been my favourite ever, always. Yeah, always watched him. And I thought, I'm going to go pro, you know. And I went to the gym. And John Conte was in the gym where I went to.
Yeah.
Good fighter. And I was used to watch him train and how he got treated. And I was up there, and the trainer came in to me and he went to me, "Listen, I'm going to be very honest with you." He went, "You're not going to make it in the pro world." He said, "You're too small. You should be a jockey." I said, "Funny you should say that. My dad sent me away to be a jockey." I said, "But I only lasted 6 weeks." I said, "We were getting 10 shillings. In them days, it was the old 10 shilling note. I said, 10 shillings a week. And we had to wear caps. And we had everyone who walked through the yard, we had to salute and say, 'Yes, sir. Yes, madam.' And be polite." I said, "And shovel that horse shit." I said, "And they would tell me it was going to take me ages before I would ever get to the stage of riding horses." I said, "So after 6 weeks, I just walked out." So I said, "And I love sport." And he went, "Well, look, you're too small to be a professional boxer." He went, "But look at John." He went, "John Conte is unique." He said, "You know, you'll never get that." And then he went through how much I would earn, what I'd have to pay out, how hard it would be to get fights. Because dripping wet, I wasn't even touching
it. So matching up as well, yeah.
Yeah. So he said, "Why don't you go back to this club? My dad runs it. He's looking for an assistant trainer and help out." And that's how I got into training. And then my dad formed a club in, him and his colleagues formed a club in the Elephant and Castle called Trinity Youth to keep kids off the street. So I went and joined that club. And I became one of the junior trainer there. And then I became the senior trainer with Billy Kingwell. And then I moved to another club called the Hollinson. And a lot of my fighters were going through. In the meantime, I'd given up catering. And I'd got myself a pub. And I had a pub in East London. And I opened a boxing gym on the first floor. And I got a phone call from a guy called Kieran Murphy. I have to be very careful what I say here because I can't get sued because this was when Frank Warren started out. This is all factual. That's good. And they started a company called Pirate Promotions, Kieran Murphy and Frank Warren. Certain people don't like to be reminded of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And they came to, a couple of my fighters, they wanted to sign, and the fighters would only go if I would go as trainer. So they asked me to become a trainer. So I applied and got my
license and stuff, yeah.
And I became a professional trainer. And obviously the relationship between Kieran and Frank ended quite badly. They parted.
Yeah, yeah.
And in that time I met Frank McClintock, who was also a business associate of Frank Warren's, who became a very good manager at Millwall with John Docherty. So it's all, and I became a trainer. We signed Terry Marsh. We signed Keith Wallace. We signed...
You have a big pull to get players in and stuff like
Joey
that.
Joey Jimmy Duncan, Stevie Johnson, all from Liverpool, from the St. Helens Boxing Club. Wallace was a sensational boxer. Yeah. And they all came and lived in the pub in East London with me. They all had rooms in the pub because it was a big pub. And it was going okay. Eventually, my brother also wanted to go pro, so he went pro with Frank Warren. And I was his eventually, I fell out with Frank. And I decided to leave boxing for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I got into an argument with Vic Andrietti, actually, who after that I became very good friends with him. And he took over my job as the trainer. And I stayed out of boxing for a while. And then a friend of my dad's approached me and went, "My son-in-law wants to go pro and we'd like you to manage him." And I wasn't really interested.
But you lost interest by then?
I lost interest. But I met with the kid. And I loved his enthusiasm. He was a dustman, actually. And so I said, okay, I'll apply. So I applied for my manager's license. And because I'd held a trainer's license, I got my manager's license. And that was the start of my career managing boxing. And I built up stable. I got a matchmaker's license. And I worked with the great Mickey Duff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I learned a hell of a lot from Mickey Duff.
Very knowledgeable. And
yeah. And Mike Barrett and Jarvis Astaire. And we were making a fight one day, and I had my own little stable of fighters. And I used to do my own little small shows, never made any money. At one time, I was about $125,000 in debt. And Lennox Lewis saved me. Thank you, Lennox. I had to make this fight. So I made this fight with one of my fighters who was unbeaten. And Mickey Duff had a fighter that was unbeaten. They were really building up. Yeah, I can't think of his name.
You were both going to match them up against each other.
So they asked me to match him with him. And I went, okay. I said, but we make the fight at a certain weight, which Mickey wanted it made. So we agreed that we signed the contract. And Mickey's fight came in about 5 pound overweight. So at the way, and Mickey went to me, you're going to have to turn a blind eye to that. I went, Mickey, I can't turn a blind eye to that. He went, you're the matchmaker. I went, I know I'm the matchmaker. I said, I'm also the manager of Wayne Weeks was my fighter. I went, and I'm not putting him in that ring with him because he's an up-and-coming star.
Mm-hmm.
I said, and I don't mind if it's a level playing field. So Mickey really got annoyed with me. And I went, well, if you don't, and Mickey's guy had sold like about 350 tickets because his dad was a cab driver and everything around London. And I went, well, I'll tell you now, Mickey, the fight's not going to happen. I said, I'm sorry, even if you sack me, I'm not going to. My loyalty to my fighter in this situation. So he went, okay, we'll get the weight off. How much do you want off? I went, I want it all off. He went, I went, yeah. I said, so he looks at his watch. So he said to another old character in boxing, Harry, or old Jewish boy that used to work in Mickey's office, real character. And he went to me, no one's ever spoken to Mickey like that. He said, you'll be lucky if you've got a job on Monday. I went, well, I'm not bothered. I said, My intentions are.
Yeah,
I said that weight's got to come off. Anyway, in them days, they used to put fighters in big sweatsuits, put them in the sauna. And I stayed there for 2.5 hours and I watched this kid take every ounce of weight off.
Did he get it off?
They had to get it off him, rubbed him down. They went back to the scales. He was 2 pound. I went, nope, I want it off. Went back in. Eventually, it was about 3 or 4 ounces over. And I thought, I looked at him and I thought, he can't fight.
Was he drained? Was he gone?
Absolutely gone. So I said, okay, we'll accept that. Rubbed him down. Anyway, on the night my fighter won, there was bedlam in the arena.
Did it go off, did it?
The next day, Mickey called me up the office, and I came in the office. I was coming up the stairs, and he rushed at me and grabbed me and pushed me up against the wall. He had his hands around my neck. He went, let me tell you something, Maloney. You are the matchmaker. Your job is to look after the house fighter. You could have destroyed a kid's career. And I went, and you could have killed someone if I'd let that fight go.
Yeah.
He went, if you want to stay our matchmaker, you do as we tell you. I went, not if you're using my fighters. And then he calmed down. He went, I have a lot of respect for you, the way you protect your fighters. He went, but don't try and beat house fighters. He said, one rule in boxing is the house fighter must win. You must make it like 80-20 in their favour.
Do you think that goes on in boxing? I mean,
I done it myself when I was promoting a matchmaker. When I got to a certain level, you tell your matchmakers, I want to win. You know, you could always guarantee your fighter 6-7 wins by an accident happening, by something like that.
There's a puncher's chance that he can get.
Because boxing is so unique. You know, and then 1989. Oh, then Ambrose Mendy approached me, who was another big cat. I've had so many characters in my life.
Yeah.
Ambrose Mendy approached me. And asked me if I would work with him, that he was going to sign Nigel Benn. So I went ahead and agreed to that. Then eventually Lennox Lewis came into my life and my whole life changed.
It's unbelievable what you achieved with Lennox and the journey that you both went on together, you know.
Yeah, but everyone sort of just always talks about Frank Maloney and Lennox Lewis. I had some great fighters in that time. I had Scott Harrison that won a world title, real character. Unfortunately, circumstances happened and he went off the rails.
John McDermott as well.
John McDermott, another good heavyweight. Paul Ingalls.
He beat Tyson Fury, didn't he?
Yeah.
Remember that night? It was on Sky Sports, wasn't it?
I remember that night. The only person who ever fought John one was the referee. And I remember after the referee came up to me and I went, shake it. I went, let me tell you something. At least when Dick Turpin robbed you, he wore a bloody effing mask, I swore. But I said, you have blatantly robbed someone. And I went, you only done that because John's dad kicked your ass when you was a fighter, which was true.
But then was you pulled before the board?
I was pulled before the board and I was fine. Can you believe it? I tried to get the decision overturned and they ordered a rematch. And I will be fair, Tyson took John apart in the rematch. But John wasn't John wasn't the John that fought him the first time. John had had some problems. Personal problems. He changed his trainer. I wasn't John's manager, so he didn't tell me a lot, but I found all this out after.
Later on,
But John was one of the most unluckiest heavyweights I worked with. He lost a couple of title fights on split decisions, which I don't know why. He was too nice of a guy, to be honest. He was too nice of a guy. And then I had Julius Francis, who people He came out of prison. He signed with me. He went on to win the British belt outright. He beat some real favourites of Frank Warren's. Used to love it when he used to beat Frank Warren. Yeah, his last big fight for me was with Mike Tyson. And after that fight, I did say, if I was you, Julius, I'd retire now. You can live on this story forever. It was his biggest payday. He decided he wanted to go on boxing, and we parted company.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and but things went on. Obviously, I had a fallout with the Lennox team over the new business manager that was appointed, Adrian Hogan. I didn't see eye to eye with him. And I heard a rumour that when Lennox lost in South Africa, I didn't want
to. Rachman, wasn't it?
Yes, I didn't want the fight in South Africa. I was all against the fight. I wasn't against Rachman. I was against the fight in South Africa for one reason. Adrian Hogan had got Lennox a part in a film, a 5-second appearance in Ocean 11, and it was being filmed in Las Vegas. And they moved the training camp to Las Vegas. And I said, Lennox, are you crazy? Las Vegas is 2,000 feet below sea level. Yeah. Joburg is 7 feet above sea level. We're fighting in Joburg. I said, so you've got
to go and train where it's the same. Sort
so
of,
I sent out my sports physiologist. I spoke to one of a leading rugby player in South Africa that I knew that moved there, used to play for the British Lions. And he said, look, you've got to get Lennox in at least 4 weeks before the fight.
To adapt to the altitude, is it? The
altitude.
Whatever.
Yeah. Anyway, Lennox, I sent Lennox a letter, and I've kept a copy of the letter just in case I was ever questioned. So I have got a copy of the letter. And I sent it to a couple of Lennox's trainer. I sent it to his business manager. And Lennox phoned me and said, the day Rachman comes to South Africa, I promise you I'll come to South Africa. Well, Rachman came to South Africa 4 weeks before the fight. When I phoned Lennox and told him that Rachman was on his way to South Africa, he went, oh, we'll be there. We can beat him. He's not, you know, someone got into Lennox's head. Lennox turned up a week before the fight. We went out on a run the next day. And I'd never seen Lennox so out of condition.
Blowing, was he blowing?
Even though he trained, but it was the altitude.
He's over there, isn't
and
it?
Yeah. So we've done an open workout. And I have told this story, but I've never let anyone use it. And I watched the open workout, and I always had a great relationship with the English press. And after they said to me, they came up to me when Lennox left the room, I was sitting in the bar. They went, Frank, you wasn't very excited. You wasn't your normal self.
Yeah, he knew the song.
I said, I want all your mics turned off. I want all your phones, everything turned off. I said, I'm going to say something here, which I will deny if you put this in print. Plus, you'll never get another interview again. Because at them time, we had great relationships with the press.
There was loyalty.
Colin Hart.
There was loyalty with reporters.
Ken Goodman from The Star. Lawrence Lustig. Ken Gorman. Jeff Powell from The Daily Mail. John Dillon from The Daily Express. You could name all the reporters. Now there's not one boxing reporter you could name. Steve Bunce was still around, Steve Lillis. And I said to him, Lennox Lewis will lose this fight. If I was you, I'd put my house on Rachman. Well, after the fight, some of them came out to me and went, we owe you a drink. We took your advice. Lennox got knocked out.
Yeah, I remember the knockout. And was it the ninth round, I think it was?
No, it was the second or third round. And I remember Lennox. So the Lennox team went into meltdown and they were looking for someone to blame. And Adrian Hogan wanted me to take the blame.
Did he come after you, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, and I went, I'm not taking the blame for that. I went, I told you to get to South Africa. They wanted to protect Emmanuel Stewart, who was a great trainer. Yeah, I'm not saying that, but this is the one time he made that one mistake. Because Colin Hart done an interview with him, and Colin Hart asked him about the altitude, and he went, we're world travellers. That won't affect us. That was the one mistake Emmanuel made in the whole of Lennox's career. And I said, I'm not taking the blame. And then I heard the story. I got a tip off from an English press guy that they were going to call a press conference to sack me. So I called a press conference and resigned before they could sack me.
Must have hurt, though, Kelly. Do you know what I mean?
No, it did. You know, I missed out on two of Lennox's biggest fights.
But from where you and Lennox, you know, we were speaking yesterday. Again, we went out for some food last night and we spoke at length about certain things and, you know, when you first met, it was like how he signed when you first met each other. You know, you talk about that because obviously talking about this, you know, from what you went through together, do you know what I mean? Before Lennox reached his peak.
Yeah, we had a great a great understanding. Like, you know, Lennox was the boss, always was the boss.
Yeah.
His contract was so well written. I mean, I got him because I just said to his lawyer, what do you want in the contract? And he looks at me and said, what do you mean? I said, well, what do I have to put in the contract to get Lennox Lewis? So he told me, and I went, okay, that goes in the contract. Yeah, yeah. Because I had business a financial advisor called Roger Levitt. I don't know if people, the younger generation won't know about Roger Levitt, but a real character and a con man. But the older generation will know about him. He was a financial investor, and he owned a group called the Levitt Group, which had offices in the city, had offices in Japan, had offices everywhere, but they didn't own the pens that the stuff were writing with. He used to fly around in a private plane, and he looked like Max Wall. He was a little Jewish guy with a moustache, and he always had a cigar in his hand. He used to come in. Remember the first time when I was in the office, I hadn't met him because I'd done all my deals through John Hollins, the ex-Chelsea manager, and a gentleman called Charles Meaden. The Levitt Group wanted to start up a sporting agency. They were going after high-profile sports. And they had a meeting with me, and I told them that if you could sign a heavyweight that could win the heavyweight championship of the world, and he was British, you could open your own bank. And they went, well, there's only one heavyweight that's good enough for that. It's Frank Bruno. I went, no, Lennox Lewis. They went, but he's not British, he's Canadian. I went, no. I said, he was born in East London. I said, his brother is Dennis, and he lives in London. I said, he's a friend of my brother. I said, but Lennox is British. I said, his mum took him to Canada when he was 12 years old. They checked it all up, and they came back and went, do you think you can get him? I said, maybe, but it's going to take a lot of work and money. They went, nothing's an object. We want him. So I went to work. I kept phoning his lawyer up. Eventually, his lawyer turned up. And to this, they told me after they signed a contract, they said, we only came to England because we insisted on flying first class, staying in a 5-star hotel, and Lennox wanted to see his brother. They said, you gave us everything we wanted.
You stuck to what you said?
Yeah, it took me about 3 months. I had to fly to New York to finally finalise the deal. So I told Roger Levitt's office that I'd booked a ticket. So I got a phone call from Levitt himself. I hadn't met Levitt at the time. And he went, I've been told you're good at your job. I went, well, I'm reasonable. He went, you sign that fighter. He went, or else our business arrangement is over, because he bought my name and my company. Mm-hmm. I went, okay. He didn't pay me the money that he promised me, but never mind, another story. So I said, okay. I said, I've booked a ticket. I said, I'm flying out. I'm be it on American Airlines. I said, I'm saving money. I've booked economy. He went, no one in my company or anyone is going to sign, running my sports division, travels economy. He went, my secretary will organise it. I turned up at the airport, I got a ticket. It was first class. I've never flown first class in my life. So I flew first class.
Yeah.
I stayed in a hotel in New York. Eventually, the hotel was a dive, didn't it?
So you flew first class and then the hotel.
But the hotel, it was my fault, the hotel. I stayed because there was a fight going on and there was a certain trainer. Angelo Dundee was there. I wanted to meet him and talk to him, and they were in this hotel. So when Lennox and his lawyer turned up, the hotel was so bad. I said to his lawyer, look, I've made a bit of a mistake. This hotel's not good enough for you. You go and find a hotel. So they went and found one in Broadway, and they took the top floor suite. And I was like, okay. So I thought, well, yeah, I'm going to sign him in. If I don't, it's just a gamble. Anyway, so we went through it. Eventually, John got everything in the contract he wanted. We met with Angelo Dundee and chatted, because we were looking at the time for trainers, actually, even though we hadn't signed them, but that was part of the project.
Yeah, yeah.
And Angelo never got the job in the end. Eventually Lennox signed the contract. It was April 89, and it was an unbelievable day. And his mother came to England. I had a pub in Crayford at the time, so I got Lennox a little house in Crayford.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. I mean, Crayford was sort of a working class, predominantly white area of Londoners. And Lennox lived, but he was like, he walked down the street and he just stood out, this 6'8", massive black guy, really like, and he'd come in the pub and people would just come in to see him, have photos and shake hands with him.
How did he deal with all that?
He was very good. Lennox was very good, very down to earth guy.
Yeah.
But one of the funny incidents was I got a phone call he'd been arrested. I was like, what? Lenny's been arrested? I went, what's he done? They went, he's been held in Bexley Heath Police Station. I went, so I went up. Anyway, I went up with his lawyer. It turns out Lennox was, and we had, at this time we'd signed a deal with the trainer, John Davenport, who was an ex-American Marine and prison guard, a real military guy, and a guy that really was focused on what he was doing. Mm. And I think he was a great trainer for Lennox. He taught Lennox the difference. He converted Lennox from being a top-class amateur into a good pro.
Yeah.
And he was the first trainer. And he wanted us to sign a couple of fighters that he had. So we signed all of them and we put them in houses in Thamesmead, actually. And because Lennox didn't want them too near him. They live in Thamesmead. But they came over. One was from New York, New Jersey. He was a middleweight, Tavis. I forget some terrible names. And what happened was we had got Lennox a car, part of his contract. It was a Mercedes 190 and he was driving. And the police stopped him at a roundabout. He obviously, like, and they got out. When he got out of the car, they looked at the size of him. and this other American got out, who was a real street kid. He'd been a lot of, and he went, man, if you was in America, we'd have shot you, police, because you've got no guns. Like,
and the police just.
And the police then freaked. They
called for backup.
They did call for backup. They called for a transit van, came down with a load of police. They took them both away. Anyway, eventually I went up to the Bexley Police Station. I explained the situation. And I said, why have you picked? He said, the car's not registered to him or the company that he told us. The car had been bought back, had been a repossessed car, but they hadn't changed over the bloody paperwork. So it was obviously in the
different. Yeah, so it's
fine. But they released him and they became great fans of Lennox. So he had a lot of stuff. He wasn't very happy. They had a lot of British Metropolitan Police officers supporting him. But I think of the funny times. There were so many funny times and good times. Mm-hmm. Like my daughter, who you've met, who runs this is her complex. And she grew up with Lennox. Yeah. Like he was like her big brother. He'd come around the house, sit with her. And I've got great photos of Lennox with my other daughter, when she was a baby, Lennox holding her in his hand.
In his hand.
It's so small.
It's memories like that.
I don't regret any of that, you know. And I've had, you know, I have had highs and lows in boxing. They've not all been high. You know, I had James Obola, who was a good heavyweight, won the British title for me, got shot in a nightclub.
Yeah.
I had Darren Sutherland, who was my last, David Price, and I had David Price and Darren Sutherland. Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, Darren Sutherland hung himself, committed suicide, and I found him, and that freaked me out. And then I signed Pricey. I remember I was in the hospital. I'd had a heart attack after finding Darren, and I was trying to sign Pricey at that time, and the.
It's not a deal with that as well, though, Kelly. That's just.
I was in the hospital bed, and the nurses were going mad. Like I just had an operation
on
my
phone
heart
and all that.
Anyway, so the sister came up to me and she went, "This is an award where people have had heart attack. You're supposed to be resting and conditioning." I went, "Look, my future and my life depends on signing this fighter." She went, "And I need to be." She went, "Right, I'm leaving here tonight at 6 o'clock. You can use my office. Get it done," she said. "Otherwise, I'm taking that phone off you tomorrow and you're supposed to be resting and I'm taking that computer off you." Because I was having my secretary come up to the hospital and I was running in the ward as if it was an office, you know, and I'm laying in the bed, like all strapped up.
Anyway,
So I went into the, and I signed Pricey that night. I finally got him to sign and we had a good run. I enjoyed with David.
Nice fella, Pricey.
Yeah.
You know he supports Liverpool.
A nice, good heavyweight. Yeah, he's a big Liverpool supporter. You're an event supporter. But, we had a great run. Unfortunately, I made a fight with Tony Thompson, which I thought at that time was a great fight because I worked on it. If he had beaten him, Pricey would have got a world title shot. Unfortunately, it went wrong. Thompson knocked out Pricey. And
in a heavyweight game, though, Kelly, a lot of people, it's in boxing. I don't think people understand. I mean, a lot of people do because, you know, they're not the weights and stuff like that. And in heavyweight boxing, anybody can knock anyone out. If they hit them clean on the chin.
Yeah. And also, style would make fights.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it was the wrong style for Pricey.
Yeah.
And, you know,
probably he had him rocked as well, didn't he? I'm sure he
in the second fight he had him on the floor.
Yeah.
And we
with me misses, yeah.
And we so like that fight was over, and then we, but this time my own problems had got on top of me, and I was actually transitioning very privately. No one knew about it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really...
Which we will get onto, yeah.
I wasn't really going into my office much. Emma, my daughter, was running my office. I'd moved out of my family house because I sort of told my wife what I was going through, and she swore to keep it a secret. She said, I will take this secret to the grave. I will only tell someone about it if you ever want to tell anyone, she said, you know, and I want to keep your children, like, always... see you as a dad and respect you. And she done that. So, and I have the great respect for her for that. And, you know, we're still very good friends, I'm glad to say. And I wasn't in a very good place. So I met with Pricey and his lawyer, and we discussed it. But I thought the boxing was the only thing that was stopping me from coming totally out and transition.
Mm.
And I'm convinced if Sutherland hadn't done what happened and Pricey hadn't gone the way he went, maybe my transition wouldn't have happened when it did. It may never have happened. Or it may have happened while I was in the boxing business. I don't know if I could keep it, because I was on the verge.
What were you going through at the time?
Yeah, I was on the verge of suicide, and I attempted suicide a couple of times.
Really?
Yeah, but then I'd come back to the boxing. Then I'd come back to what my father installed in me. I was a father. I had responsibilities.
Mm. So what you were feeling inside... Kelly, you know, was it August 2014? It was like, obviously, you know, you wanted to, from Frank to Kelly. Is that the time when you made the decision? Or obviously, you were feeling something, you know?
No,
how long was you feeling this?
I was transitioning.
Mm.
So I was having counselling. Mm. I was also seeing a gender doctor. Mm. And I was on hormones at the time, but no one knew.
But as well, you're in one of the biggest sports in the world. You're a public figure, and you're trying to have this secret that you're, you know, which it was a secret for you.
And I used to go away at weekends to sort of events which were organised by trans groups, support groups, and it was quite funny because I'd turn up there because I would never go dressed as a female because I could never leave my. I used to tell my house that my partner that I was going to a boxing event or I had work to do.
So you were keeping a secret? Nobody knew?
I was living a total lie.
So you were sort of like a double life?
I was living a double life, which is the hardest thing in the world.
Whatsoever.
No, and I used to turn up. I'd get there early and I'd get into my hotel room before anyone would see me, and then I'd transform into Kelly. And no one knew, and I used to go under the name of Kelly Black at the time. Black because I thought... bit mysterious, and no one must know. People would try and work out who I was and who I wasn't. I used to say that I was, some people thought I was a jockey actually because I was so small, which was nice. And I used to say I was a salesman actually, a traveling salesman. And I kept this secret for ages, and it was just, I used to come to my house in Portugal where I also would sort of the weekend live as Kelly. And go to different places.
Did you feel at ease? Did you feel like that? What you were feeling, you know, did you just, it was just a different feeling altogether?
I was a different person.
Did it just come about one day? Or
I was a totally different, no. I always say this, you know, I had such a life and such a lifestyle, and it would have continued because I had good boxers, and I like to think I was quite good at what I'd done,
mm-hmm.
and I was respected by a lot of people. Some would say, I wasn't as good as I claim I was. Some will say that I did none of my, but you're always going to get people who say things about you, and then you get people who say good things about
you.
Yeah,
of course.
You know, I like to think that I treated all the boxers quite fair, and I kept my word on most, on 90% of it, 99% of everything.
You're honest, and sometimes people
too blunt. I was very blunt.
I think it's a good skill to have.
I remember having a couple of fights in my room and just saying to them, I've got to tell you this, please don't give up your day job. And they'd look at me, I said, you're not going to make it. I said, I was told this once. I said, I'm telling you now, so please, you know, you could have your contract back or you're just going to be a journey fighter. And I don't really want to manage journey fighters. I know it sounds arrogant, but, you know, I was top of my league.
Mm.
And I just wanted to be that way because I knew how hard it was, you know.
But dealing with all that as well, that feeling of not wanting to be Frank no more.
I think I'm always going to be Frank, you know. I have to be honest. The trans community like you to say, like, your dead name or the right. Part. But I don't see Frank as my dead name.
Yeah, right.
For 60 years, I was Frank Maloney. I can't hide from that fact.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I've transitioned. I've become the person I believe I should have always been. I'm a much happier person. I'm much more stable. I see things through different eyes. And I see, you know, I grew up in a world that was only black and grey. Sorry, white and black. There was no grey area, no other. Now I see the world through so many different colours. And I respect, I've learned to respect so many people. You know, I said so many things that were wrong as Frank Maloney because I was trying to hide and deflect everything from me. And, you know, I learned.
You're only human as well.
Yeah. And I also learned, you know, what Mickey Duff once told me, you know, he said, remember this, no press is bad press. And if you say something bad, the next day it's only chip paper. Well, in them days he was right. But unfortunately, there's the internet now. So everything
media.
I've said is on the internet. You know, since I changed, I mean, the comments I made about the gay community when I was involved with UKIP, comments, you know, I've made about female boxing, because at that time, female boxing wasn't going to be accepted. It wasn't the sport it was now. I had one of the first female boxers, and I went to Sky and told them, and they told me, we don't want her on our shows. If you put her on, we will not show her, you know, and that was then. But things have changed.
Things
now.
Have changed massively now.
Yeah.
In the things that you said with UKIP and stuff, do you obviously regret them things, or do you apologise for them?
No, I did apologise. When I transitioned, Nigel Farage contacted me and asked me to come and speak at their convention in Margate when they were really on a high.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I stood up there, and if people see my speech, they will see me publicly apologising for my comments and saying that I'm no longer a member of UKIP. I joined UKIP because I just thought I don't know why I joined UKIP. I do like politics, and I follow politics, you know.
There's a lot of opinions.
Yeah, there's a lot of different opinions. But it's like, you know, my dad always said to me growing up, two subjects you never talk about. Politics and religion. And do you know what? He's quite right, because you can open up a can of worms.
It opens it massively. It just...
everything.
Because if someone doesn't agree with what you're saying, and I think in today's society, you do find a lot of people get offended by... And it's not necessarily because you're right and they're wrong. It's just, that's just your opinion. And what I find is there's a lot of people that do get offended. That no one wants a full blaze row, do you know what I mean? People have their own beliefs, and people have their own...
I'm a great believer everyone has a right to an opinion.
Yeah, of course.
And I mean, that's something, though, that people put me forward as a spokesperson in the trans community, an activist. I'm not a spokesperson. I'm not an activist. I put my own opinions forward that I believe...
You're your own person.
...person. And that, you know, I always say I'm a human rights activist. I want everyone to be respected the same way, because we all enter this world the same way. And guess what? We're all going to leave in a wooden box anyway. So in between, what happens is just...
If that makes you happy
life,
as a person, as long as you're not hurting anybody or offending anybody along, you know, because what you believe is what you believe.
Well, it's respect.
Yeah, of course it is, yeah.
I mean,
and we learn that from an early age. You have models in life where you learn to speak to people how you expect to be spoken to.
I mean, I get called from some trans groups saying, you need to speak up on this, because someone has said, and I go, that person's entitled to their opinion. Not everyone's going to accept us in the community. But I say this, as long as they respect us, that's fine, because they can't deny our existence. We're here. And it's how we present ourselves and how the public sees is what counts. You know, I don't have a problem if someone says, I don't believe that you could be born in the wrong body. That's your opinion. That's fine.
They don't know how you're feeling.
They don't know how you're feeling. Yeah, you know, until you've lived in someone's shoes. You know, I make comments about certain things, as I said before, because I was trying to deflect it, and I'd never lived that. But now I've actually been brave enough to make that decision and sort my life out and stop living a double life. I now realise how hard it must be for people.
Yeah, how did that feel, Kelly, to live that double life? And then how did it feel to obviously make the decision that you were going to go through what you were going to go through?
To live the double life, I would not ask anyone to do that. It is the most horrifying thing you can do, because you don't know.
And especially being in the public eye.
You don't know who you can trust, who you can tell. You don't know what to do. You have responsibilities, and then you have the fear of being rejected by society if you decide to make the move. You have losing your family, losing your job, losing everything, to be technically.
Family, that must have been somewhere you were very up.
Because I'm very close with my family, yeah, you know, yeah. We are quite very well bonded. And, you know, my daughters have been my rock. They've helped me through this.
You've got three daughters, haven't you?
Yeah. Well, without them, I wouldn't have got to where I am today. But when I did that transitioning, and I did make that brave decision, that move, it felt like a total weight had come off my back.
Massively.
You know, and now I live a very simple life, a very contented life. And
I know, supported by your daughters and your family.
And I'm a much happier person. Though I had everything, I wasn't happy. That's the biggest thing. I had everything you wanted. I had a chauffeur. I had 3 or 4 cars in my driveway. I had a big house.
Doesn't make you happy, you know.
You know, I didn't have to queue up to go into restaurants or nightclubs. You know, and I...
You can have everything, basically. Yeah,
I've got 3 tickets to go to Millwall now. I can buy them.
Millwall.
You know, but the one thing that was missing in my life was the happiness. And I was destroying everything around me. I was destroying my family. That's really what was hurting me most.
Yeah, you just... You had all the luxury of, like, people think now people want all this, you know. It doesn't make you happy.
No.
If you're not happy within yourself, and you can have X amount in the bank, or you can have a big massive house, or you could have so many cars, and you can have all this VIP treatment. But if you're not happy inside, or, you know, you just feel like the world's caving in on you, or you know what I mean?
It's just, I can't explain the feeling. And I think my eyes were open when Darren Sutherland committed suicide, and then someone else in my life committed, Dean Powell, who many people in the boxing world will know Dean.
Boxing legend.
He was a legend. Yeah, he was my right-hand man. He actually helped build my company and was brilliant at what he'd done. And, you know, I was here in Portugal on holiday trying to sort myself out, and I got a phone call telling me that he'd thrown himself under the London to Brighton Express train. And, you know, them two things made me think.
Two people who are very part of your life.
Life.
That, you know, anybody losing anybody is traumatic. And it's,
and then a promoter that I was working with from Hartlepool called Gus Robinson, we were doing a joint show in Sunderland. He had the fighter that was the British champion, ex-soldier, really good little fighter. And on the Wednesday before the show, I got a phone call. They found him hanging in his garage. And he was a very successful businessman.
This is like, there's so many things that go on in people's lives. You know, that people, you know, you have a front, you have a mask, you put this front on and all that, and, you know, you, just some of the people you've named there within the boxing community who are well respected, and, you know, boxers now of past and present, you know, they can have this front and they can have this, they're a great boxer. I mean, you know, they're in the gym, they're punching bags, they're doing pads, they're training together, they're laughing, they're joking, but no one knows what's inside.
And that is the problem. I mean,
that's going on in the head and inside.
See, I describe my life as Frank Maloney, as someone who got up in the morning, got out of bed, and put a suit on, a mask that would protect them out there in the world. And that mask was that bold, brash little cockney that didn't care what he said. But that wasn't the real Frank Maloney. The real Frank Maloney is the person that's sitting here now.
Mm.
And that's why I say I will never disown Frank Maloney, because that is part of my life.
Yeah.
And that's who made I am today. The rights and wrongs that he done has taught Kelly how to be a much better and more decent human being.
And it's made, you know, not today, you're a lot happier, you're a lot,
yeah,
you're loving life, you know, you, obviously like you go back to the UK when you can and stuff, but you're like, you settled here in Portugal and stuff. And
yeah, I don't think I mean, I will eventually go back to the UK. You know, I still got my house there. And I need to see me all in the Premiership before I pass away.
All in the Premiership, I think, bloody hell.
And I don't know what the future holds for me. Obviously, I'm retired there.
Mm.
You know, I do get asked the question, do I miss boxing?
Yeah.
And I have to be honest, I don't miss it no more because it's totally changed.
Well, that's what I was going to speak to you about. So obviously, you know, we've just been flowing and stuff and there was a few bits I wanted to go on, but it's just been brilliant the way it's flowed, you know, and stuff. And, you know, in boxing today, you know, with all the boxing promoters, we spoke again last night about it yesterday and stuff. And the likes of Eddie Hearn, you've got your Frank Warrens, the Salem Brothers, you've got Gold Star, Ben Shalom, GSW, Stephen Vaughan, Dennis Hobson. What would you do differently if you were involved, still involved in boxing today?
You know, I don't know because it's very hard. I'm very old, very old-fashioned and very traditional.
You can't be,
you know, when I walked away from boxing, the internet, social media was there. I mean, I had started using it and, you know, using it to good effect, but it's a lot different today. I don't like these celebrity fights. I don't like these YouTubers. I don't like the idea that all the great fights are now in Saudi Arabia. You know, I think it's
with the Saudi thing now, I think, because they've got that much money and the rights to this, that and the other, the boxers get paid absolutely.
Yeah, I don't blame the boxers for taking the money.
Because
it's such a short career, they have to take that money.
Oh.
But I blame certain people in boxing for sanctioning certain fights, allowing certain things to go on.
We spoke about that one yesterday. I mean, you said about Joshua and Ngannou last week. And Joshua done what he had to do.
Yeah.
And so we should. No disrespect to Ngannou, who in the UFC and the...
Ngannou shouldn't have been in the ring with Tyson Fury or with AJ. You know, all right.
These crossover fights, that's the word, the crossover fights.
Jake Paul. I mean, who the hell's Jake Paul?
Well, another thing we were saying as well was, you know, with the likes of Jake Paul, he's got that much pull on like social media and stuff like that. And listen, business minded, you've got to take your hat off to the lad. He can box, but then you've got boxers, and I see this all the time. You've got lads who have boxed and, you know, I think it was Derry Matthews actually. Scouser Derry Matthews said the old route used to be like going from like a European Commonwealth.
It used to be an area title.
Yeah.
English title, a British title, European title.
Commonwealth.
Maybe need Commonwealth, an international belt, and then a world title. Now you can fight for a world title after five or six fights. You know, I had a boxer. I sometimes still get a phone call from certain boxers and they ask me questions. People, even in the promoting business, that have phoned me. I mean, I got offered to go back as a consultant to a new promotional company that's starting up. I don't know if they'll ever start up because what I told them they nearly fell off the seats, I think, when we were talking. You know, people think everyone's rich in boxing. There's only a few people that are rich in boxing. But going back to, this one boxer phoned me, and I won't say which promoter it was. He's got a decent record, reasonable fighter. It would have been a fighter that I would have signed. But he wasn't asked about his ambitions or what he wanted. He was asked how many social media people he's got following him on social media. So that shows you how boxing's changing.
Instead of obviously, you know, is he a good ticket seller?
That's the idea. If he's good on social media and he's got a lot of following, he's going to sell that.
I think that's the way boxing has gone now with obviously technology and stuff like that with you know, the social media side of things, different platforms. I do get, you know, for boxing promoters, like the big guys, you've got like the likes of Hearn and Warren and Gold Star and all that who have got these channels, the Zone, Box Nations back and stuff. But then you think about, like, you know, the up and coming, you know,
Hard for young promoters, you know. That's what I said to these guys when they contact
me. It's hard. People don't understand. Yeah. We were saying again, you know, another conversation. You know, it's people look from the outset, and because they think there's like 500 or 1,000 people or 2,000 people in there, you're freaking raking it in.
You're not getting that at boxing no more. I know certain promoters in London, they're running shows like with 16, 17 fights on them, so they can just get people through the door. And then as soon as one, like, there was two promoters who worked together, and they ran two shows in one to cut their costs down.
Mm-hmm. Work together?
Together, yeah. So that, you know, because you haven't got... I grew up when there was real boxing fans, right, who would go to their fights no matter where they was, who they was, you know.
He loved up, would love to see boxing.
I can go back to the time of, again, I'll name Liverpool fight, Billy Aird, Joey Singleton. You know, I'd go and watch them, the Finnegan brothers, Conte that we spoke
John
about.
Conte, yeah.
And you'd see the same faces in the front row if you went to Wembley or to York Hall or to Liverpool Stadium, because we had true boxing fans. We no longer have true boxing fans. Yeah. We have event fans now that go boxing.
You know, the fight card, it's whoever's topping the bill. And we've just started sponsoring a fighter ourselves. He's super middleweight, Jack Power. I've got to give him a little mention because he took an unbelievable following to Leeds. And it was on a GSW show in Leeds. He sold over 450 tickets, the lad. It was his debut in Leeds, and where we're from, in Runcorn, just outside Liverpool. All right, it's only an hour and 20 minutes up the road or whatever. When that, I just think, you know, you get behind, you know, and you go on this journey together, all years. And I think sometimes it's, you know, you get these, you know, these, like you just said there, how many followers have you got on social media? Yeah. That to me is a boxing promoter's, you know, start.
That's your job as a promoter. Yeah. To raise the profile of it. I would always say to him, how many tickets could you sell? Then I'd say, right, we've got to work out how we can sell tickets. What football club do you support? Try and get him at the football club. David Hay claims to be a Millwall supporter. I was the one who told him to do that. I don't think David Hay's ever been to Millwall, but I'm not. So I won't vouch that. He has been to Millwall now, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you know, Lennox Lewis. We said he was a West Ham supporter. Lennox didn't know much about football because he was never brought up in this country.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember Millwall.
That affiliation and getting like that support behind them.
One of the funny things with Lennox, I remember Millwall got into the old first division. It was the only time we ever got in up high. And it was 1989 when we had John Dockett and Frank McClintock as our managers. We had Teddy Sheridan, Cascarino, Cahill. We had a great team. And we were playing West Ham. So I took Lennox to this to Millwall.
And it was Millwall West Ham?
Yeah, and he had a West Ham scarf on. But obviously where I sit was among a lot of Millwall supporters. So he sat down and they came in and they were looking at him. And they were like, who's that, Frank? You know, get him out, he's got a West Ham. I went, I'd like to introduce you to Lennox Lewis. He's Olympic. And he stood up and they went, oh, he can sit here. And they all loved him. Do you know what I mean? Because he didn't really know much about football. But it was like, that's the sort of thing you do. You break down barriers by being...
Yeah, you've got to... And like you're saying, as a promoter, and like some of the promoters have already mentioned, you know, don't get me wrong, you know, I have a little go myself at trying to do events and stuff like that, not on that scale and stuff, but like you say, you're pushing a boxer's career and stuff. And like I say, with young Jack there, you know, he sold 450 tickets on his debut. I think he's fighting in Liverpool on May the 11th.
I'd make sure he keeps winning if I was his promoter.
Yeah, but
I'd go in the grave, as Mickey Duff said, go to the graveyard and dig up a body. That's what I would do. Seriously, I'd go to the graveyard and dig up bodies.
But he wants, I think they're going to put him out four times this year or what. I don't know. You know, this is the stuff we've spoke about. And he's so ambitious and, you know,
You've got to learn your career.
Yeah.
You know, it's anyone can get to fight for a world title. I remember that. I can't remember which trainer said it to us when we were building Lennox. They went, the easiest thing to do is get you for a world title. The hardest thing is to keep the world title. Because once you've got it, someone else wants it.
You've got somebody else wants.
As a champion, you've got to train harder than you trained as a challenger.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to stay there. It's such a cutthroat business because you're only as good. It's not like football. Football, you can have a bad day because you've got 42 games.
You've got 10 other lads to back you up.
Boxing, Yes, it's a team that gets you ready, but it's the fighter that steps in that ring. And once that bell goes, he's on his own. And one punch can change his career. One punch can, you know, when Lennox got knocked down by Oliver McCall in the early 90s, and we lost the world title, it took us nearly 3 or 4 years to get back in a world title fight. We had court case after court case. We had to fight everybody that was put in front of us because they were trying to stop us to get back to the world title.
Onto this title back, yeah.
So it's really hard. You know, the world has boxing has changed now. To me, there's too many titles. There's too many belts. The sanctioning bodies will sanction any. The sanctioning bodies will sanction two flies as long as they can get a fee out of them.
It's crazy what goes on in boxing. You know, we could talk what's in, but do you think in today's boxing the boxers look well looked after? Say, for instance,
only certain boxers, and it's always been the same. To me, boxers are the most ill-treated sportsmen of the lot. They are like a can. Why they're flavor of the month? They're doing well. They go wrong. Most fighters, most promoters will try and drop them, or managers will drop them, or they become a journeyman. They're not looked after by the British Boxing Board of Control. There's no aftercare for boxers. There's no talk about, it's one of the only sports that actually don't talk about dementia. Now, you can't tell me boxers are
taking the blows that they take.
And it's not just the blows, it's the sparring. And this is something I've always brought up and talked about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know what, there's no pension scheme set up for boxers like in football.
Well, that's what I was going to say, the PFA, like you'd have Gordon, what's his name?
Taylor.
Gordon Taylor, you know, you know, which is great for the, like, former football, ex-footballers that, you know, retire or they have an injury or they become ill. They look after them well. Do you not think that should be brought into boxing?
No, I do. You look at the government. The government has sent up think tanks to look in nearly every sport. What sport haven't they done? Boxing.
Mm-hmm. You're saying about football, like headed in the ball. It's part of the sport. You know, you've got headed the
but
ball.
But they've got a study on dementia.
Yeah, yeah.
Boxing buried ahead with dementia's concerns.
A lot of boxers suffer with dementia, you know what I mean?
But I'm talking about the Board of Control, the governing body. The governing body could do a lot more for British boxers. They, you know, the big
money that's in boxing as well, though, Kelly.
Well, that's, certainly promoters make more money than most football clubs make. A percentage of money should be put in a pot for boxers, and each boxer should have to pay in a certain amount of money every fight, even if it's only £5 or £10, depending on the scale of boxer. Mm-hmm. And they should receive a pension like footballers at the end.
Because it's like on the scrap heap, there's you know, boxers as I've grown up and I've watched and stuff, and you see them and, you know, they've had it's a tough sport, boxing.
It's a tough sport, it is.
It's a tough sport.
It's a tough sport, it is, you know.
And then you see them with, like, going back to work on, what's the name?
Do you know, and I was part of that. So I can't, you know, I probably should have done a lot more when I was a promoter. But because I look from the outside now, I see it totally different.
Yeah.
And I see boxers. You know, boxers really are used like pieces of meat sometimes. You know, and use meat when they're no good. You know, some are very lucky. Tony Bellew is a very lucky fighter.
Yeah.
You know, he gets on very well with Eddie Hearns, and he's got personality, so he does television. You see, Spencer Oliver's done very well. You know, since boxing, he had a brain damage on one of my shows, you know. And then you look at fighters like one of my champions, Paul Ingalls, who's mm-hmm. got a brain, he's got no spot. He got an insurance payout from the British Boxing Board
Control. That's the word, isn't it? Aftercare. For boxers and stuff like that.
They should be taught about their career,
things after boxing,
life after boxing. There should be classes sort of set up for them. They should, about how to get into a trade, how to get into a business. They should, you know, they should be taught how to handle their money.
Business management and stuff like that. And just,
there's so much the British Boxing Board of Control could do to make themselves a really good organisation and to make boxing a decent sport.
And it does come under a lot of
stick,
the big boxing, you know, the British Board, you know.
Well, maybe they deserve it. It's an old boys' club. I don't care, and I used to say this when I was a licensed manager, a licensed by them. They are an old boys' club that are more concerned about the trips abroad and how much gin they can drink when they're on trips.
I'm not the first person to say that either, you know what I mean? So it's, you know, there's no smoke without fire, you know. So I mean, it's, but like I say again, you know, a lot of boxers, like you say, they turn to drink to what's name afterwards because they're just after, you know, they've always done boxing, they were always in the gym. There's not that aftercare afterwards where they could go into. No,
because, you know, if you talk to Frank Bruno, Ricky Hatton, you know, they, what happens all of a sudden that adulation, that 90,000 people or 20,000 calling out your name has stopped.
That adrenaline, that buzz that you get.
So what do they do? Look at what happened to poor Frank Bruno. He was one of the greatest sports, you know, sports personalities we ever had. He'd done so much for boxing.
Yeah.
But look at what he went through when there was no one there to help him.
He was always
in the newspapers, you know. Poor Ricky Hatton. They destroyed him. You know, he was a national hero.
Remember him taking 20,000 over to Las Vegas?
Vegas,
20,000 people went over to Las Vegas.
The same papers that built him up destroyed him when his career was finished.
I think Ricky spoke about it. I've had Ricky on a couple of times, on a couple of shows I've done, and he spoke openly about that buzz. You know, the train, the camps and all that, even though it was hard, because he did used to balloon and all that, you know what I mean, and stuff, but then he'd get the weight off, and he was a phenomenal fighter, he was an animal, you know what I mean, but then, I remember him saying, he was talking, you know, after dinner, and he said, like, he felt lost, he didn't know what to do, he didn't know that buzz within the gym, he just felt, so he did, you know, like I say, drink, and other bits and bobs come into play, and he's not the first person to do that, you know, when he certainly won't be the last.
You can go back to Ken Buchanan. You know, there's so many great fighters, Terry Downs, people like that. Mm. You can go back for a year and it's always some great American fighters. It's always tragic with, you know.
There's always something, like we just touched on, there should be a lot more for fighters, aftercare and stuff like that. And I think it does certainly does need to be looked at, you know, and maybe, you know, with the money that is involved in boxing today, maybe that's something can be put together for.
Do you know what? There's a charity that's set up by people that are involved in boxing or was involved in boxing to set up a home for retired boxers. And a lot of the people that are in boxing or ex-boxers do a lot of like parachute jumps to raise money, certain stuff.
Fundraising
to build this home. One guy has looked at it. I think he lives in Hastings. I'm sure he was licensed. David, I can't think of his surname. But he has taken it aboard to try and get this project done, which I think is a remarkable thing. But I don't know if the British Boxing Board have donated anything towards it or offered to help, because they should. You know, they charge sanction fees. They make every fighter pay a license fee. They make every fighter pay a percentage of his wages. So I don't know too much about it, so I can't really comment on that. But, you know, when an individual is trying to set that up, why is the official body not got something like that running?
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? Again, like you say,
you know, and boxing is also its own worst enemy. Too many world champions, too many sanctioning bodies.
And we want to see the best fighting the best as well.
Do you know what I mean? I always describe boxing as theatre with blood, and it is the modern day Wild West. The biggest gunslinger is the one that pulls all the cards. And at the moment, the two big gunslingers are Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn.
Well, that's what I was going to touch on. What do you think about them two finally coming together?
Well, I mean, money's brought them together. You know, the Arab money's brought them together. Will it be good for boxing? We hope so.
Yeah.
Will every boxer benefit from it? I don't think they will. You know, the elite will. Because, again, it's all about money.
It's different, you know, levels. But
you know, Frank
stable.
Is older than me.
Yeah.
I mean, and he's still going on, you know, that, you know, I think Frank is the only true boxing promoter out there left, to be honest. Mm. Eddie Hearns is an event promoter. He's a great promoter, but he's an event promoter.
Mm.
You know, he has changed the face of boxing.
I mean, I was going to say Eddie Hearns has become, you know, he has become the face of boxing. That's my opinion. I think, you know, from Sky, and then he went off, you know, with The Zone and stuff like that. And Frank Warren, obviously, you know, I think Frank's got a couple of sons who in the background do their stuff, who do phenomenal work. It's the same with like Frank Smith with Eddie Hearn and Matchroom, and it's good for boxing. And I think now, obviously, if money has brought them together, well, so be it. But we want to see the biggest fights, like this UFC with Dana White in America. They fight the best. And no disrespect to Dana White, he's a businessman. I'm not going to try and tell him to do his job because he'd probably just fucking laugh anyway. But they get the money that they get paid, which is nowhere near what these boxers get paid. Do you know what I mean? And I just think we want to see and I think now it's happening in June, you know, in Saudi, they're having five of Matchroom's best and five of Queensbury's best.
Oh, let's see who the five are.
I think they're going to do a London show in September, I think, is it? Or whatever. That's what the boxing fans want to see. But what you said before, we want to see boxing fights in the UK. The UK boxing fans are the best boxing fans. You know, different countries just say they are. Do you know what I mean? You've got the Americans, you've got the, you know, all.
I think we always loved the trip to Las Vegas because it was something special.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can behave the same way you behave in Las Vegas in Saudi.
Oh, no. I don't even think you can bevy over there, can you? Not have a drink.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I know that I spoke to, I won't say which lawyer, but going to one of the fights, and they went, Kelly, I'm not sure if you should go because of their LGBT views. You know, I didn't go in the end, but that wouldn't have.
Would you have felt because of the view?
No, I don't. I don't really.
Yeah.
Worry about things like that. Yeah. I would go if I wanted to go.
Yeah.
But in the end, I just felt I didn't want to go
because
but
of their beliefs and all that.
I didn't want to feel the water. You know, I am who I am.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just go where I want to go. If you don't want to accept me, that's fine. If you want to throw me in jail, throw me in jail, you know. That's, you know, just be another chapter to the story of Kelly Maloney.
So, well, like I say, with boxing today, with Warren and Eddie Hearn, do you think it is a good thing for boxing?
Yeah, you know, I've got the utmost respect for both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Would I like to be battling with them? No. I think comes the stage. I've looked at people in boxing like Mickey Duff.
Yeah.
He got old and bitter and twisted when he started losing power. You know, I never wanted to be like that.
Mm.
I was always preparing myself for the day that my life at the top would end. You know, I always...
Oh, you've got to where you've achieved, where you've reached and stuff like that.
You know, what I've achieved, no one can take away from me.
Yeah.
You know, I was a kid without an education, came out of school with no qualifications, and I reached pinnacle in the field that I wanted to. And it wasn't just one world champion. I had five world champions, and I called proper world champions, and I had dozens of pajama champions, as I called them, you know, the WBU, the world's biggest underpants title. you know, and all the other belts. I used to have names for, but I never used to say the names publicly.
Yeah,
I used
to
keep these names, you know. But
that takes a big. But I'm saying from yourself, you know, you're dyslexic, like you said, you didn't really what's name at school, and look where your life took you. You know what I mean? Where you were chef, and I don't think you really what's name at that. Yeah, I think you quite the hospitality type of thing or managerial type. And then you've used them experience to go on to be one of the biggest promoters in world. And you know, and have some of the biggest.
Well, I was a reasonable. I was a reasonable boat, you know.
Everybody, and I worked with, you know what I mean?
Learning to work with people, like meeting people like Don King, going to Don King's.
Bob Arum as well, yeah.
Bob Arum.
What was Don King like?
A very interesting character. Very funny man. You know, Don made me famous. I mean, I always, you know, have a lot of respect for Don King, you know, and he christened me the mental midget, the pugilistic pygmy. I mean, that made me world famous in America, you know.
Imagine saying that.
And, you know, and he used to go and say, I feel sorry for you Brits. You want this mental midget, pugilistic pygmy, to run your machine. And his greatest saying was, Lennox Lewis is, I can't remember what sort of airplane he said, but you've got this one who can't even fly a plane during his career. And, you know, and I go back, and they're the things that motivated me. The first one that was ever
said against
me
wrong, yeah.
was Mickey Duff when we made Lennox Lewis and Gary Mason. I remember that fight. Gary Mason was number three in the world. Lennox Lewis had just won. Lennox was European champion.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Mason was British and Commonwealth champion. So the board had ordered the fight. I think it was Lennox's 10th or 11th fight. Mason was free in the world, and Duff was so confident, and he told someone, I'm going to knock that upstart out of boxing. He went, you know, he's done Cecil D. Mills in reverse. Cecil D. Mills was a great showman and made great events. Well, he was saying that I've done something totally different. And his partner, we mentioned his name earlier, but he turned around and said that why would you put a cart horse trainer to train a thoroughbred? I mean, Lenz was a thoroughbred and I was a cart horse trainer, that I should only train average fighters.
That's a spear, just on
and
just...
So that really motivated me.
Yeah.
And I remember when we was at the press conference in London and we'd made the fight and Mickey Duff was there and the press were asking him, and he turned around and said, what's your response to all of this, Frank? You know, like, I went, do you know what? I have the utmost respect for Mickey Duff. He is the number one in British boxing. I am just learning my level, but I would not make this fight. And they go, what? I go, Gary Mason is number three in the world. He's got everything to lose. Lennox Lewis
got nothing
has to nothing to lose. Lennox Lewis was an Olympic champion, was a national champion, fought at international level. Gary Mason never won a divisional title in the ABAs. He's been well managed and well matched.
Pushed through the
air. I said, and he will be exposed. And Duff went mad. Well, what happened? Lennox exposed Gary Mason and finished Gary's career. Totally wrecked his eye, didn't he?
Yeah.
On that night. And that was one of the biggest nights ever. I was brilliant. I partied for 3 or 4 days. Seriously, I did. It was one of the best times of my life.
That feeling, you know, when people like, not undermine, you know, everyone's entitled to an opinion and some people get a little bit arrogant and a little bit.
Mickey was very arrogant.
No better feeling. Like, I remember people saying to myself, laughing at me, saying, you're deluded, Jim. You'll never get Nigel Benn. And I always remember saying to my wife, like saying to my missus, she's going, Tony, your head's ticking. What are you thinking? I went, I'm going to get Nigel Benn. She went, you're f***ing mad, you. She called me another word, actually, and she said, and I went, and I made the phone call. As you do, you make a few phone calls and whatever. And I brought him to where I'm from, Runcorn. And I've worked with Nigel a couple of times. And it wasn't like to go, no, to people, because I'm not like that. I'm not. But when people laugh at you, and you just think to yourself, you just go, I told you to do it. And that's how I always watch the name in life. Now, if you want to do something in life and you're passionate about something, don't let nothing stand in your way. Yeah.
And you also got to learn to select people. I remember, as I say, about the Lennox story, Roger Levitt, and it turned out all Roger's money was fraud, and he got arrested for 90 million pound fraud, that he spent people's money and never, not a penny of it was his money. And he actually hadn't paid Lennox his signing bonus. And I had to go and tell Lennox this. And, you know, Lennox said to me, I said, Lennox, I'm sorry, you know, I don't know how I'm going to keep your career going. And this was just before the Gary Mason fight. So this all happened. So I got Lennox to go to training camp. I put it on my credit card. You know, and Lennox said to me, as long as you find me another sponsor and you get my money that I was supposed to get, I'll stay with you. And I went around the world seeing people, trying to arrange it. Eventually, I did arrange it, who was actually an ex-associate of Roger Levitt's.
You had work in that alone.
Yeah.
The pressure of like trying to find another sponsor.
My world was so... But do you know what happened? I found out, and it was something my dad said to me when Lenny started to raise, and he went, remember this, the day it all stops, you'll find who your true friends are, and you could count them on one hand.
I think that's the game.
And do you know what? It was so true. When people realised I didn't have the money and that Levitt had gone under, I was getting dropped by people left, right and centre. Who at that time, were inviting me to dinners and inviting me out. So when I got everything back together again, I was very selective in who I let into my life.
Mm.
And, you know, these are lessons you learn.
You learn this along the way, don't you?
Yeah.
It's a life lesson, isn't it?
It's so important to learn. If you don't learn by your mistake, you're a fool.
Mm.
You know, and I've learned a lot by all my mistakes. And sometimes I wish I could go back and start my life all over again, which we can't do. And know what I know now, and I would be a much better boxing manager, a much better promoter. And
we wish we could all do that, because we all make mistakes
and
in life.
And a much better human being.
Yeah, but a human, you know, that's it.
Now, the last part of my life, I'm on the downhill slope now. I'm heading towards that wooden box that I talk about. And, you know I'm a better human being. And that's what's so important to me.
I just wanted to touch on, obviously we spoke about Don King. He told me about Bob Adam. There was a famous... And then you still...
Oh, yeah, I still used it. I remember Bob Adam, it was questioned at a press conference, and he would go, and I used it. I can't remember which fight it was, so I used it. So they said to me, "But Kelly, Frank, you said yesterday this." But I went, "Yesterday I was telling a lie. Today I'm telling the truth." I went, and I learned that from Bob Arum, by the way. And they just sort of looked at me. So, it's just, there's so much you could talk about, but boxing is very, you have to be very careful what you talk about and what you say in boxing, because it's a great sport for getting someone into court and suing them. You know, when you write a book on boxing, when I wrote my autobiography, it had to be read by about three or four different lawyers. I let Frank Warren's lawyer read it, or Frank Warren read it. I let Lennox Lewis's lawyer read it, and someone else's lawyer read it, and obviously my own lawyer read it. And quite some of the stuff, like stuff about Don King and certain stuff, was all taken out.
Which is all in the book, yeah.
But when he... No, it's not in the book, because it was taken out.
Oh, was it taken out?
So when he dies, I'll be able to say it all. There's a lot more I could say, as long as they die before me, that is.
You bloody hell. But, you know, going from, you know, your autobiography and stuff like that, did they all come back and say, like, no, don't be... All four of them, or was the...
There was a couple. Lennox asked me to take two things out of there, or his lawyers did. And Frank asked me to take one thing out of there. And do you know what? I wasn't confrontational, so I took them out. I didn't, you know...
You didn't want to hear it.
Yeah, my lawyer said, you'd probably get away with it. But I just thought, you know what? I'm still in the business. I don't need confrontation. I don't need to be in court every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So I took them out.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, Kelly being accepted into society today and the boxing world, and what's your opinion on people's voice on trans and stuff in today's society?
Everyone's got their own opinion. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. Everyone may never agree with it, but that people don't have the right to deny anyone's existence. We are who we are. I've not changed. I can still talk football. I can still talk boxing. I can still have a laugh. I still enjoy life. All I've done is change the outside wrapping to be a complete person and a genuine person and a happy person. I'm more happy today than I was when I was managing Lennox Lewis. And to me, that is the best thing of it all. Mm-hmm. I'm no longer hiding the true me behind closed doors. With a scarf up around their face under the name of Kelly Black. I'm out there, and all I ask is that people respect me. They don't have to like me. They don't have to want me in their life, but just respect me as a human being. Yeah. To me, that is more, and respect other people. You know, I don't understand all these different genders, these different sexualities,
yeah.
But if that's the person's choice, and it's not doing me any harm.
Yeah.
Yeah. As long as they treat me well, I'll treat them well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, look, you know, do you think children in the UK or all over the world would be able to find their own path, you know, in life in regards to finding their own sexuality?
I do. But I also think it's something that you just have to let the child. You know, I get asked this question a lot when I do talks. And they go, what would you do if a child came? And I go, I would do nothing. I would just let the child develop. If it's a boy and he wants to wear princesses' dresses, I would let him do it. But I wouldn't make a big fuss of it as if it's something. I wouldn't go, you shouldn't be doing that, because... And I wouldn't say, oh, you look lovely. I'd just go, yeah, if you want to do that, that's okay, you know. And just let the kid find his own level. They will find their level. They will find if it's true. I knew at a very early age I was different. I didn't know what the problem was, mm-hmm. because at that days there wasn't the knowledge there is today. I only knew when I read the story about a Liverpudlian person, April Ashley.
Yeah.
As very famous first person to have full gender reassignment in the UK, I believe.
Yeah.
And you've got a museum to her in Liverpool.
You're right.
I was about 12 when I read the story about her. She was exposed by the newspapers and I felt so sorry for her.
Just hung out to dry.
I was 12 and I read it and I went, this is me. I feel everything this person is saying, this woman is saying. And I thought, but I'm never going to let anyone know because of what this paper has done to her.
Is that kind of,
I kept the story for ages. I kept them, you know, in a box. I used to cut everything out about trans people or people that had, at them, they used to say, change your sex. I used to cut everything out about them. But, you know, I've not changed my... Biologically, I'll never be a female. I'm a medically constructed female. I will present to the world that I'm a female and I want to be treated that way. Biologically, I'm always going to be a male. I'm a father, aren't I?
Mm.
You know, again, I've upset quite a few people in our community because I still let my children call me dad.
Mm-hmm. Whose what's name is it for them to
even say the judge? It's whatever
to tell you to, you know, your kids.
And if it makes my girls had to go through a lot. They had a famous father. You know, they had more boyfriends than anybody because of who I was. And you know, also when it all changed, they got abuse. They got picked on.
Yeah,
you know,
affected so, them as well. You know
them,
what I mean?
You know, this journey's not just
you're
about
going
me.
Through all that as well, Kelly. And then you think to yourself, the girls and, you know, obviously your elder daughter, Emma and stuff, and for them, how they dealt with it. And you're probably, what you're thinking, it's not just me. Got to think about everybody else, protecting everybody
else.
Well,
it is. You have to do that. If you don't, you're not a decent parent. Because one thing, you can't be a parent for 5 minutes. You're a parent for life.
Of course you are, yeah.
You know, you're a parent for life. And you have responsibilities for life. And... you know, I remember my daughter, I remember telling Emma, and it was Emma. Emma has been on my phone, I've got like little things for my daughters. Like one's the princess, one's the special one, one's my rock. And they're all like, you know.
That's what comes up on your phone.
When they ring. And Emma, you know, when I told Emma, I could see in her eyes, it broke her heart and it broke all my, but Emma just put her arms around me and she went, you know what? I prefer my dad in a dress than in a wooden book. And I've always kept that in my head.
That's always stored. That's never left.
Yeah. No matter if you wear a dress or what you do, you're still my dad.
Mm.
And that to me has been, and she helped my other two daughters along with Tracy, and my ex-partner. And, you know, my daughters actually say I'm a better parent now than I ever was because I wasn't there a lot when I was in the boxing business because, as you said yourself, you're working 24/7 because you need to be successful.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the only way you can be successful.
Or you want to deliver who you're representing. Or
what I was a good parent in providing for my children, but I wasn't there to give them the love, affection that a child might need when they're growing up.
Of course, yeah. Like you say, you know, it takes a lot to speak about that and admit that, where some people play it down and like, I'm fucking great and I'm like, listen, we can all play that one way, and that's, I think it's a thing in life where as a man or as a husband or even as a female, it's what we do. We want to provide for our families because where they, you know, they can come to us, that's your job, you know what I mean? And but when you're trying to get to, you're doing things, you want to provide, you want to have a nice house, you want to have, you know, nice things and stuff. But along the way, you know, sometimes there's feelings and stuff.
And you've also got to teach your children that, you know, you don't get these things, they're not given to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to work, you have to earn them. But you don't want to earn them and you don't want to get them by losing the respect of other people.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing worse than seeing someone that's rude to other people. You know, I've always brought my children the way I was brought up. Try and be kind to people. Always remember this. There's always someone in a worse position than you.
Yeah. Speak to people how you expect to be spoken to. You know, have respect. You know what I mean? And stuff. It's just proper having models and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, it, unfortunately, people don't understand, you know, them type of models and get offended when well, if you're going to speak to me in that way, I'm going to reply back and speak to you in that way.
But it's the society we live in, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And we try to change it too much. You know, woke. I mean, woke is a crazy thing. Why can't someone say, you know, you can say, like, I get attacked on social media. Sometimes I laugh at it. Sometimes I think it's a bit strong, you know. But how I deal with it, knowing that person would never say that to my face.
Yeah, when you get trolls and stuff like that, and you do get that, you know, people are behind the keyboard or they're behind the phone or whatever. And then sometimes, yeah, you've seen people take it into their own hands where they've gone and confronted these, and you see the backside fall out of them. They go like an ice cream in the sun. They just go to pieces.
I'm going to keep that. It's a good saying.
It is. You know, but it's mad, isn't it? You know, when...
I always say it's like you know, they're keyboard warriors who are at home in a little room drinking Stella and jerking off and playing on their keyboard. That's true.
No, listen, and a lot of people who fire back at them saying you're probably in your mum's box room, fucking, you know, whatever. Yeah. But listen, it's just like today's society, which I agree with you. It's not nice to abuse people and whatever. And look, we can all have banter. But then you can give and take banter and stuff, but when you go a little bit below the belt or whatever. Yeah.
And sometimes you go into a football club, like obviously, or into a boxing gym, and you may hear things that you may not think is right. But if you're not from that world, you don't understand.
People do get offended where, yeah, like in that environment where you can have like a stable of lads or even there's a stable with women in as well.
Yeah.
And they're having like a football could be your Millwall, Liverpool, whatever. Oh, he's got Tonk last night and that banter, you're fucking this, that.
And some people, you know, I mean, there's certain things that are said, you know, in the gym. And you might, if you said that, I remember once when I took one of my daughters down the gym. And there was some shouting, and one of the trainers was really saying something to a black fighter. And the black fighter turned around and gave as good as he got, you know. My daughter looked at me and went, that's terrible. I went, they don't mean it. It's just
banter.
It's just gym talk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I went, you know, they wouldn't say that outside.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And they wouldn't.
And what goes on stays, yeah. You know what I mean? It's one
and,
of them.
You know, I just think, I don't know who's done it, but we tried to, we can't be no one can be 100% perfect.
No.
And the world can never be 100% perfect. And that is the problem. There's people trying to
too
make
too many people try to be perfect in life.
Yeah, and there's no sense. If we were all perfect, there'd be no crime, there'd be no need for jails, there'd be no need for policemen. So we can't be, you know, we're all, even me, I've done things, terrible things, you know, or I bent the law to suit myself sometimes, you know. We all do.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can't live in a perfect world. If you want to live in the perfect world, you're in the wrong place. That's what I say.
Well, I was going to touch on Celebrity Big Brother, Celebrity MasterChef, and obviously like loose women, you know, take on, you know, being on Celebrity Big Brother and
Celebrity Big Brother was wrong for me.
Yeah.
It was too soon.
Yeah, yeah.
But I came out a bit better and stronger thanks to certain people in there that helped me.
What's the name, the thought behind going on Celebrity Big Brother to see you?
Well,
do you know Kelly what? Or?
Yeah. It was only about 6 weeks after my story had broke. There was big arguments in the family about me going in and not going in. Certain daughters wanted me to go in. Certain daughters didn't want me to go in because, you know, it's...
It was still raw to them, was it?
It was raw to me. I wasn't really ready for it. I don't think I'd come across very good. But the money was good, so I have to be honest about that.
I think everybody knows it's everything big, but the money's decent, you know what I mean?
It was, and I was able to make a donation of $20,000 to my support group from my money. So, you know, and that
so
was
you
one way
them back
of,
as well.
That was one way of me paying them back for what they how they helped me through all my problems. I went in there a wreck. I was a bit of a wreck in there all the time, but I came out stronger and I came out a better person. And I had some help in there from certain people. D. Kelly, D. White from Benefit Street that was in there with me. Ricky from Geordie. Yeah, is it Geordie Shore?
Geordie Shore, yeah.
George from Gogglebox. Audley Harrison was in there with me.
He's had a little bit of Barney, didn't
he? Yeah, and there was a dancer in there from, was James, whatever his name was. He was a complete prat and an arsehole. Yeah, I wish I'd waited to go in there, to be honest, because it wasn't the Kelly that you're talking to now.
Yeah, yeah.
It was Kelly that was full of tears, emotionally disturbed.
Something that you've been living with, and it finally get it out, and then 6 weeks later, you're on people's TVs. Only, do you know what I mean?
The only good thing about it was what my counsellor said to me was, Kelly, and what the woman from my support group said to me was, Kelly, what you got to understand is, you're in everyone's front room. You're in 2.5 million people's home at prime time, and they are actually seeing what a real transsexual person's going through in their transitioning.
Mm-hmm.
No, this may never be witnessed again. Because they've had transsexuals in there, but they've had transsexuals that have already transitioned and been living in their roles. So they witnessed the rawness of someone going through transit. And, you know, my lawyer was very good. He made a point they couldn't film me at the time I wore wigs. They couldn't film me in bed. And I was given a separate bed away. I had my own bathroom. They wasn't allowed to film me.
Yeah, obviously, because the cameras are all over the place. But
I had horse everything them days and plastic everything. You know, before I went on camera, I would be putting stuff everywhere, putting hair on my head, and so I had all that to contend with. But I came out a stronger person. I came out more bullet, and it also helped some of my daughters, because some of the stuff about me wasn't all bad. There was bad stuff, obviously. Mm. You know, there was, as you say, the trolls, the idiots. But there was some very positive thing. Mm. What a brave person Kelly is. She's showing us what people are going through. This is seeing someone in the raw state. Mm. You know, so it did help.
And someone who stuck up for themselves as well, because you fronted a lot of stuff head on as well. You know, obviously, I've got to mention it, the thing with Audley Harrison, where Audley sort of like...
Oh, I forgot about it, yes.
Yeah, well, and listen, you know, being within the boxing world and stuff, and Audley and yourself, and you know what? Stuck to your guns, though, do you know what I mean?
That was the best moment of Big Brother House, because I converted all... I remember that, you know, I use it sometimes when I'm talking, because Audley voted to nominate me to get out, and we'd made a pact that we'd work together and help talk to each other. So I said, Audley, why? I was so upset. I said, Audley, why have you nominated me to? And he said, I'm very uncomfortable. I don't feel, I don't see it's right. You in the same bath as me, sitting in the tub. He went, okay. I said, but why? What's wrong? I'm not naked, you know? Mm-hmm. No, but I said, okay, let me change it around, Audley. What if I nominated you and said I was uncomfortable sitting with you because you're black? Mm. And Audley went, he stopped, and he went, never thought of it like that. All my life.
He broke down as well, didn't he?
Yeah.
He broke down.
He said, all my life, yes, I've suffered prejudice. And he gave me a cuddle and said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I understand what you're saying. And after the event, his wife came up to me, because, you know, he lives in Los Angeles, and his wife runs a beauty business. And she has a number of transsexual clients. And she said, Audley never used to speak to him. And she went, he told me he now understands it all, and that he'll be...
So when you've spun the sort of tables have been set.
Yeah.
And
to me, that was probably one of the best moment of Big Brother for me. And I think that helped a lot of people understand, because it is right. It's fear and prejudice. Mm. It's fear of the unknown. And that's what's wrong with that was what Audley's problem was.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was Celebrity MasterChef.
That was interesting, yeah. I think I shouldn't have been thrown off of that. I was very upset. That one I was very upset, because I thought Celebrity MasterChef was about I got to the semi-finals, obviously, and I thought, you know, it was about inventing dishes, and I'd done a pork dish with a cherry sauce, and I remember Greg Wallace, who I know previously, because Greg is from South London, Peckham as well, and he claims to be a Millwall supporter.
I was going to say, he's not Millwall as well, is he?
No, he claims... no, I think he is, actually, yeah. I know Greg. Well, I sort of know him. I've been out to dinner with him before, I'd been in the Big Brother house. Celebrity MasterChef. And he went, oh, this dinner's like a fruit salad. He said, who's ever heard of having pork with cherries with pork? And I wasn't well. I actually clapped after that. I was taken to hospital after that day.
Surprised you didn't sling it all over.
Well, no, I should have said to him, hold on, before a chef invented applesauce with pork, who would have ever thought of having apple with pork? Or whoever would have thought of having orange sauce with duck before a chef? You need someone to invent it, and this is what slavery. But I wasn't thinking straight. I just knew that I was going to get voted out,
yeah.
And Raisin Ruddick was going to be kept in, who burnt all his food.
You know, who else was on there with you?
Dillian White.
Dillian
White. He burnt his fish. And what's her name from The Chase? Not the governess, the other one. She was nice. I liked her.
Yeah.
And also in there was a guy not Coronation Street, the EastEnders. Vicky Patterson was in there. Greg Rutherford, the Olympian, he went on to win it.
Yeah.
DJ Judge Jules and the weatherman from BBC. What was his name? Can't remember. Yeah, no, it was good. I enjoyed that. It was quite good. I think Dillian White was a bit uncomfortable with me because of our previous relationship. I enjoyed that, you know. But sometimes it's about if your face fits as well.
Yeah.
It's not about how good you are.
Yeah, that's it. Well, with Loose Women, what was the score with Loose Women?
Loose Women, I enjoyed Loose Women because he was able to talk. I've done Loose Women a few times, actually.
Yeah. How were they all on set? Were
they
all?
No, they were very good to me, very friendly, very accepting, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, no, you know, I've done a number of television shows, but I've sort of now retired. I don't do a lot now. Hardly do any, to be honest now. I turn more down than I accept these days.
You're still getting calls.
Feel that I've done enough now, and I just want to live a peaceful life now. I've got my life story coming out in, it's just been a British distributing company just bought the rights to it. I don't know when it's going to be released.
Is that going to be film or
a film.
Documentary?
It's called Knockout Blonde, the Kelly Maloney story. And it's won a number of awards at film festivals. It's great, all about the boxing. There's some boxing scenes in it that I've never been seen. And there's some, obviously, stuff.
Loads of scenes, footage and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. So I believe it may be out sometime around about springtime.
And somebody's got that ready to...
And I've got, you know, I've had a documentary on Channel 5. I've got a documentary on Amazon's called Frank to Kelly. So my life's been quite hectic, but I've now decided it's time at my age to sort of take time out, chill, and start ticking things off my bucket list.
Yeah. That's what it's all about. And so, like I say, you know, life in Portugal, you got your little place, you're happy. You know, obviously you're back in suit of the UK now and again. Just the last thing, would you ever consider going back into boxing?
No, not now. I don't think I'm up to the modern day standard of boxing.
But your opinions, do you think that would upset a few people?
It may do. I would like to see, I would try and change the face of boxing if I was in it. That's the problem. I would need a hell of a lot of money to do that. And a lot of support, which I don't think I would get. Boxing is a very greedy sport. You know, it's what I said earlier. It's the Wild West. It's whoever's got the biggest guns in them holsters. You know, and let's be honest, it is Eddie Hearns and it is Frank Warren. Mm. They're even bigger than the American promoters now.
Mm.
You know, the
that's only good for us, being from the UK and us UK fans. That's why we want to see big fights in the UK. You know what
but
I mean?
Will we see them in the UK? Because the Saudis have got the money. And the Saudis, you know, it's not just boxing, is it? They've bought golf, they've bought football, they've bought tennis.
It's just another world over there, isn't
it? And they're going to buy every sport up because they're trying to get respect. Because one day they're going to run out of oil and they're going to need something else.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's what they're trying to do. They may have seen how great Vegas was, but because of their religious beliefs, they can't do certain things. But big sporting events they can do. Oh, the Grand Prix didn't have a big one they've got, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah.
They have three or four Grand Prix.
They're just snapping everything up, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So I don't think we've seen the end of them snapping up important events. You know, good luck to the young people, the sports people, that they just take the money while you've got the chance, because sports careers are very short careers.
Yeah. Kelly, I just want to say, listen, that was really interesting podcast, and I just want to say thank you very much for giving your time and inviting us over and, you know, sharing your story. I know obviously you're not doing much now and stuff like that, but like me, Chris, you know, the Good, the Bad and the Ugly podcast, just want to say thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Cheers. Thank you.